Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Bible Worm. Come socially distance yourself in our biblical cocoon. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock. I'm joined this and every week by my friend and colleague Dr. Amy Robertson, Biblical Scholar and Executive Director of Congregation Beit HaVerim, a synagogue in Atlanta. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text both as scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian. This week, the narrative lectionary finds us in Mark 12, 28-44, where Jesus gives the great commandment and a widow gives her last penny. We discuss the twin commandments to love God and love neighbor, and whether they can really be separated. We wrestle with the story of the widow's mite and whether she is being commended or exploited. And we struggle with how to make sense of this text in the middle of a pandemic, where we're all struggling with how best to be communities and people of faith. We're glad you're here. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Amy, how are you this week?
I usually say I'm doing fantastic, but it's been a week.
My school just got canceled today. We're going to go online. Your school district got canceled today, right?
Yeah, all the Atlanta public schools in the area are closed indefinitely. And we're trying to figure out how to keep our synagogue community connected to one another and also safe. It's a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot going on for us and for people listening as well, I imagine. So we'll try as best we can to speak about these texts and how they relate to our current, like our very current situation, as well as not just to the context generally, but also to the, like, here we find ourselves in
a pandemic. Right,
this moment
right now where we are.
Okay, so starting in Mark chapter 12, verse 28. One of the legal experts heard their dispute and saw how well Jesus answered them. He came over and asked him, "Which commandment is the most important of all?" Jesus replied, "The most important one is, Israel, listen, our God is the one Lord, and you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your being, with all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is this, you will love your neighbor as yourself. No other commandment is greater than these." What do you make of Jesus' response to the question, which commandment is the most important of all?
The first thing I notice is that there's, you know, it's a two-part answer, right? Mm-hmm. And so the first part has to do with the individual's relationship to God.
Right.
"Hear, O Israel, the Lord is your God, the Lord is one," which Jewish listeners might recognize as the Shema, right? Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. This prayer is recited multiple times daily in the Jewish community. It's really very central. It's what you write on the scrolls that are hung on doorposts. Like, this is a very central prayer in the Jewish community.
And you find it in Deuteronomy 6:4.
Yes. And then the second part of it is relationship with other people.
Right.
Which is also taken from the Hebrew Bible. It's taken from Leviticus 19:18. "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." This reminded me of the story that is in the Talmud about two rabbis named Hillel and Shammai. You know this story, right?
I do.
Bobby?
Yeah, I love this
story. Yeah, it's a good story. So Hillel and Shammai, this is like the first century BCE. And in the story, a learner, someone who's interested in converting to Judaism, goes first to the door of Rabbi Shammai and knocks on the door and says, "I want you to teach me everything there is to know about Judaism, but I really want you to sum it up. Just be real tight in your summary here, and I'm going to stand on one foot while you teach it to me. So, like, you have to teach me the whole thing in the amount of time that I can balance on one foot."
And Shammai is kind of famously like a curmudgeon, right?
Yes, he's a curmudgeon. He's very attached to legalities, and he is really not interested in that exercise.
Right.
And finds it kind of insulting, you know, that you would ask me to reduce the glory of the detail of my traditions down to what I can say while you balance on one foot.
Yeah.
So he throws the guy out, says, "Forget it, I'm not doing that." And the person then goes to the door of Hillel and knocks on his door. And Hillel answers him as he stands on one foot and says, "Do not do to anyone that which is hateful to you. That is the whole Torah. All the rest is commentary. Now go and study." So that aligns really with, you know, the idea you shall love the neighbor as yourself and do not do to anyone else that which is hateful to you is really sort of the core teaching that both Jesus and Hillel are pointing to.
Yeah. All the rest is commentary. I like that.
That doesn't mean you can ignore the rest of it.
So a couple things that I noticed here. One is, I don't know if this is important or not, but in Deuteronomy 6:4, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. Mm-hmm. Here, Jesus says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your being, with all your mind, and with all your strength.
That's
he adds
true.
A fourth term.
Sure did.
And I take the Deuteronomy passage just to mean love the Lord with everything you got.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so Jesus is also saying love the Lord with everything you got, but he's sort of added in the mind component.
Mm-hmm.
I like the addition of mind because it's not taking anything away, but
of course you do. You're a big geek.
Yeah, a total geek. And so this says the life of the mind is valuable, and it should also be oriented toward God. It shouldn't be something else. Like, that needs to be oriented toward God as well.
I like that a lot, actually, and the thought that, the sentiment that thinking deeply about these texts and thinking critically about these texts and really engaging them with all of the intellectual force that we can muster is a good thing and is a form of loving God.
Yeah. The other thing to say about these two things that Jesus says, and I think this is fairly obvious, but like, love God, love your neighbor. Like, these are, we talked about it a couple weeks ago, as this is basically the two tablets, so to speak, of the Ten Commandments. Like, love God is commandments 1 through 4, and love your neighbor is commandments 5 through 10. So Jesus has kind of said these two things sum up the Ten Commandments, which is the essence of the Torah. So then, starting in verse 32, the legal expert replies. The legal expert said to him, "Well said, teacher, you have truthfully said that God is one and there is no other besides him. And to love God with all of the heart, a full understanding, and all of one's strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself is much more important than all kinds of entirely burned offerings and sacrifices." When Jesus saw that he had answered with wisdom, he said to him, "You aren't far from God's kingdom." After that, no one dared to ask him any more questions. So here we have the legal expert who is so affirming what Jesus has said, but also kind of expanding or like amplifying it a little bit. What did you make of the legal expert's response to Jesus there?
I kept wondering, is this what the legal expert already thought?
Mm.
And Jesus just put words to it?
Right.
And so he's sort of saying, yes, you're right in all of that. And I don't know, adding some flourish to it.
Yeah.
Or did the legal, was it a real question the legal expert didn't know?
Yeah.
Or did he have something else in mind and Jesus's answer persuaded him that that actually is more important than burnt offerings?
I mean, so the legal expert clearly recognizes it as a good answer, maybe the best answer.
Mm-hmm.
But that I hadn't really thought about that question of whether that was like, if the legal expert would have said the same thing before asking Jesus, or whether Jesus has said something to him that he's like, oh, that's right. That's right on.
Yeah.
Like the way that kind of the way I read it, like, you have truthfully said that God is one and there is no other besides him.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of makes me think he already thought that.
That part definitely reads like, you are correct.
Yeah. Like, check.
Ding, you ding. Have won $1,000. Yeah.
But the combination of that with the love your neighbor as yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's one other thing that we might comment on is the legal expert said in verse 28, which commandment is the most important of all? And Jesus responded with two,
with
love
two.
God, love neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, one way of reading that is that, you know, you can't really separate these two things in Jesus's mind, like loving God is loving neighbor is loving God.
Mm-hmm.
And so what appears to be two commandments is really two parts of one.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the legal expert is kind of drawn to that idea, like, oh, I was expecting you to say that first part, but this second part maybe is something new.
I don't know. I think that last part where he says this is much more important than all the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices.
Yeah.
I mean, he couldn't possibly have expected Jesus to say the most important commandment is this sacrificial, you know, like, is this sacrifice.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And so that's part of the reason why I think maybe what Jesus has done that the legal expert is being drawn to is that combination of love God, love neighbor.
Yeah.
Because doesn't that, when he says to love one's neighbor as oneself is much more important than all kinds of entirely burnt offerings and sacrifices, aren't you hearing like Hosea 6:6, like, I desire mercy, not sacrifice? or like Amos 5, where Jesus says, I don't want your festivals, I don't want your assemblies, I don't want your burnt offerings, let justice roll down like water. So there's this theme in the Hebrew scripture that what God really desires is not worship, and primarily what God desires is not worship. God desires justice for the neighbor.
You know, it's so easy to get focused on the really concrete stuff that you have to do, right? And there are very concrete instructions about sacrifice, and it's very easy to just get fixated on those. And the prophetic texts offer a corrective to that and say, like, you can't do that and ignore all this other stuff and think that they, you know, that's an effective way to connect with God. Like, you have to have the big picture stuff before you can drill down into that detail.
Yeah. So one could take love the Lord your God as like worship God properly in all the with all the appropriate rituals or sacrifices. Mm-hmm. And those texts in the Hebrew scripture say, no, love the Lord your God means ensure justice for the neighbor. And then you can also worship God with all the appropriate rituals and sacrifices. Mm-hmm. But if you do the rituals and sacrifices before you love the neighbor, then you're not doing it the way God wants it done.
I think that's really good.
So one of the things I love about talking with you is we're like two scripture scholars who like we're bouncing ideas back and forth. And you'll say something and I'll be like, oh yeah, and that reminds me of this thing. And I'll say something and you'll be like, oh yeah, and like you could do this with that. To me, that's what Jesus and this legal expert are doing a little bit, is Jesus has said, here's this thing that I think. And then the legal expert says like, oh yeah, and you could connect that to like Hosea 6:6. He's taken what Jesus has said and he's like doing some stuff with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're like Bible worming it along a little bit. You know what I mean? Like, they're like,
I mean, and I love it because it's coming. The immediate conversation before this is that, you know, there is, what's the word?
Contentious?
Contentious. Yes. Yeah. The immediate conversation before this is contentious. But even when we've had conversations that haven't been contentious, it's been Jesus as the authority teaching to someone.
Yeah.
And in this case, Jesus offers a teaching to someone who takes it and adds something and she I love that.
So when the legal expert gives Jesus back his like reflection with kind of expansion, then Jesus says,
right, so on my man.
Yeah, that's exactly what Jesus says. So Mark says that Jesus saw that the legal expert had answered with wisdom. And then Jesus says, you aren't far from God's kingdom. Now, I feel like that's a pretty big deal for Jesus to say that to somebody. He hasn't said that, like, to anybody.
Yeah. No, and to, I mean, to a scribe.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So again, like, far be it for us to just sort of stereotype categories of people in these stories, right? Each person acts on their own accord. But that this story started out as the scribe who maybe used to look suspiciously as Jesus just by virtue of being a part of that group says like, hey, Jesus is actually given some good answers here and starts a conversation. And then Jesus also can speak to that scribe as an individual human being, not part of that group, and say, hey, that was a pretty good answer too.
Yeah.
You know, it's nice to see them really sort of see each other beyond their labels or, you know, their conflict as groups.
This last line of this passage in verse 34, after that, no one dared to ask him any more questions, seems weird to me because, like, Jesus just had a super positive interaction with this guy. And it's like, yeah, you're awesome. And, like, you're like, right next door to the kingdom of heaven. Like, good on you. And now everyone's like, oh, I better not say anything. What?
I know. I mean, do you think it's that the scribes sort of, like, raised the ante by being able to engage in a smart way in conversation with Jesus? And so people are like, whoa, that was like...
Yeah, and maybe they're like, it's easier. I mean, we see this all the time in our contemporary context, right? It's easier just to pick at someone else's ideas than it is to like think constructively with someone else.
That's true. Like this last conversation really sort of like flipped the mood.
Yeah.
You know, so something fruitful could actually come out of a real discussion if we're not just trying to trick each other and one-up each other. And
then everyone else is around is like, oh, I don't know if I can handle like actual discourse.
Right. Yeah. Right. I was just picking a fight.
Yeah. I can pick a fight with you, but I don't know if I, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is interesting.
So in the next verse, 35. While Jesus was teaching in the temple, he said, why do the legal experts say that Christ is David's son? David himself, inspired by the Holy Spirit, said, quote, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right side until I turn your enemies into your footstool," end quote. David himself calls him Lord, so how can he be David's son? The large crowd listened to him with delight. Now, this is interesting because Jesus is now, he has imagined the religious leaders picking a fight with him. Like, now he's, like, playing both parts of the conversation.
It's like a straw man. Yeah, he set up a straw man. He's going to knock it down.
No one dares to ask him any questions, so Jesus is like, fine, I'll just ask a question. Like, what?
I'll ask myself questions!
Yeah, I'll ask myself questions and then tear them apart. So this is not, like, what's going on here is not the most obvious thing to me. I think I understand.
It surely is not.
So, apparently the legal experts are claiming that the Christ, that is the Messiah, is David's son. And Jesus is saying, why do they say that?
Right, and the idea that the Messiah is the son of David, like, from the line of David.
Yeah.
Right? That's not an unfamiliar idea to us.
It's not at all.
Right? That sounds like a, that sounds not crazy to me. Okay.
I mean, we talked about it so much in the fall that you were like really excited when there was a text that wasn't about that.
I know, it's like boring. But yeah, right. This is not, it doesn't seem like a weird idea, but okay, why doesn't Jesus like that idea?
So what Jesus is doing, is saying, look, in this psalm, David refers to the Messiah as my Lord. Mm-hmm. And that is an argument against the claim that the Messiah is the son of David.
I mean, I wonder if what Jesus is getting at is, you know, son of God, not son of David.
Yeah.
That's the only angle that makes sense, that or that sort of comes to my mind.
Like, don't call him son of David, call him son of God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty good interpretation. I was not going to go son of God. I was going to go son of man, which Jesus has referred to himself as a few times along the way. Like when the Son of Man comes and comes in glory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he sure has. And every time I'm like, you mean God.
Yeah.
Let me correct you.
I think this is where I'm going to come out is Son of David seems to imply a messianic figure who's going to restore the kingdom of David. Like that's the traditional understanding.
Yes, true.
Son of Man goes back to Daniel chapter 7, that son of angelic figure, divine figure coming down out of the clouds and being given eternal rule over the cosmos. So one way of reading what's happening here is Jesus is saying, don't call me son of David, call me son of man, which means I'm not restoring the kingdom of David. I am coming to take rule over the world forever in a totally different kind of way.
That is very interesting. So he really is saying, you know, so as we've gone back in this gospel, we've had moments where there has been a recognition that Jesus is the Messiah, but then we immediately said, but Messiah doesn't necessarily mean what it turns out to mean in Mark, right? And so this is sort of like an inflection point where Jesus is really pointing to a different meaning of Messiah.
Verse 38, as he was teaching, he said, watch out for the legal experts. They like to walk around in long robes.
Yeah.
They want to be greeted with honor in the markets. They long for places of honor in the synagogues and at banquets. They are the ones who cheat widows out of their homes, and to show off, they say long prayers. They will be judged most harshly.
Up until we got to, like, cheating the widows, I was like, well, I want to wear long robes and be greeted with honor in the marketplace.
Yeah.
Hello. But, yeah.
I like your robe. Why, thank you. But things took a turn for the worse there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, those first couple things don't necessarily seem so bad, do they? Like, I walk around in long robes and I like to be greeted with honor. Like,
I mean, it's like self-aggrandizing, you know, like, beware the self-aggrandizing religious leader.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But it wasn't like inherently like evil stuff until we got to that. The NRSV says they devour widows' houses. That is not good.
No, the devouring is terrible.
Don't do that.
I really love that image. I like that better than the CEB. Like, who cheat widow.
That was a devouring.
Y'all couldn't see that, but Amy just did a really scary devouring of a house or the camera.
It had a sound.
Yeah, it was.
Well, but it doesn't work with it. Yeah.
That devoured the houses of widows is a lot stronger than cheat widows out of their homes. Yeah. I mean, that's bad enough, but it doesn't quite catch it.
And I really like, for the sake of appearance, they say long prayers. Come on, we all know a religious leader who does that.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And what's interesting to me is these things, so it's not exactly that it moves from like wearing long robes toward cheating widows. It goes from seeking honor to devouring widows' homes and back to religious,
yep,
like saying long
appearances.
Prayers.
Yeah, yep. It sure does. So they're the religious all like appearance, intermingled.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So be aware of people like that. And then that last line, they will be judged most harshly. So this is kind of a consistent theme in Mark's gospel, is that especially religious leaders who are engaging in the task of being a religious leader in order to gain honor for themselves, while at the same time producing injustice for the most vulnerable, those are the people who really come in for judgment in the gospel of Mark.
You know, in that, in the sacrificial texts, which I know Mark is not super interested in, but there is, you know, they talk about different ways that people can sort of go astray and the kinds of sacrifices you might need to make to make all right in the cosmos again when that happens. And the most grave of those is when a community leader does it, because they lead everyone else astray with them, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think the recognition that, I mean, they're both is sort of an insult to the integrity of the position, and that is real, and I sort of feel that in my, you know, kishkis. But
your what?
Kishkis, it's like, it's a word for guts, like a Yiddish word for guts.
I love that.
But as religious leaders, like people try to follow your lead.
Yeah.
It's not only you who's getting yourself in trouble, but you're leading a whole congregation community down a bad road. So you do deserve greater condemnation. Yeah.
That's really well said. Okay, so then moving on to verse 41. Jesus sat across from the collection box of the temple treasury and observed how the crowd gave their money. Many rich people were throwing in lots of money. One poor widow came forward and put in 2 small copper coins worth a penny. Jesus called his disciples to him and said, "I assure you that this poor widow has put in more than everyone who's been putting money in the treasury. All of them are giving out of their spare change, but she, from her hopeless poverty, has given everything she had, even what she needed to live on." I mean, this little story cuts in a lot of ways in my mind, and I'm torn about how to interpret it, really. But maybe first we should just think about, like, what's actually going on in this story before we think what do we do with this story?
I am picturing a place where people are giving donations. In my head, it's to the temple or the synagogue.
The collection box for the temple treasury. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's right. It's like the, they're
mine just says into the treasury, but yeah, like it's like the collection plate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're passing the offering plate or whatever you do. Yeah.
So it seems to be in some kind of maybe public place where you can see how much money people are putting in.
Yeah.
And lots of rich people are putting in lots of money, which I'm adding this to the text, but looks impressive to see them put in all their money. Yeah. And then there's a poor woman who comes in and puts in a very little bit of money. And Jesus is far more impressed with her offering than the offering of the rich folks. As he should be.
Wait, say more about that. Well, I agree with you, but say more
about
that.
She doesn't have any discretionary income. Like, the rich people are giving of their discretionary income, and they're showing how much discretionary income they have. And so it's, you know, it can maybe make them feel like they have achieved some kind of honor or whatever. But they're not necessarily actually sacrificing very much by putting that money in there. Whereas she's giving this little bit of money. And in doing so, you know, we've talked a lot about the importance of vulnerability in community and giving up what you have so you can't be self-reliant. And that's what she's done. She's already poor. She's given the little bit of money that she has. And in doing so, she's really come into a lot. Like, she ties herself to the community. She ties her fate completely to the community.
No, I like that. This woman reminds me, like, when I read this story, it reminds me of my grandmother. She had 4 kids, and her husband died. So my dad was 9. So her kids were 10, 9, and 6, 6-year-old twins, when my grandfather died. And so my grandmother raised 4 kids. This was back in, like, the mid-40s, early 50s.
In the States?
In South Carolina, working as a secretary She raised four kids. And so, I mean, it was all always kind of touch and go. And she kept a little box under the bed. And every time she got a paycheck, she would take out, literally take out 10%, put it in the box. And the next time she went to church, she would take that 10% and give it to the church. And she did it before she bought clothes, before she bought food, before she bought anything else. So yeah, and I think about that a lot, and you know, how putting the religious community first, and like the and she really did think about it that way, I think. Like, God will take care of her. Like, she needs to pay her respect and God will take care of her. I really think she did.
Yeah.
And so Jesus, so what he says is, this woman has put in more than everyone who's been putting money in the treasury. All of them are giving their spare change. So clearly this is a critique of the rich people who are not putting in enough money, or putting in like just what they can spare.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to me. So what he says about her is, she from her hopeless poverty has given everything she had, even what she needed to live on. Now, you and I have both been reading that as a commendation of her. And I think you can read it that way. But Jesus doesn't actually commend her.
True.
He just observes what she's done.
Okay, keep going.
The other way to, another way to read it is, we just had a critique of a religious leader in verse 40 who seeks a place of honor and cheats widows out of their homes, steals money from poor women. And then here we've got this poor woman who's had somehow, I mean, if we read her in line with what we just read, like the reason that she's poor is in part because the religious leaders or the people of wealth are depriving her of money already. And then she gives the last thing she's got to the religious community instead of having it for her well-being. So it is possible to read this text as a critique of the religious community for exploiting the poorest of the poor by telling them they need to give their money to the religious community, when the people who actually can afford to give money to the religious community are holding back, but giving money in ways that make them look good.
Yeah, I can totally see how you could read this as saying the system has doubly, not quite abused, but has doubly taken advantage of this woman.
When I read it that way, what I have in mind is like, I mean, and you know, this is like a little bit of a caricature, but what I have in mind is like televangelists who are on TV telling poor people that the reason that they're poor is because they need to give more money to God. And then the poor people are sending their money to this rich televangelist who like buys another jet.
Right.
And then they just end up even more impoverished.
Yeah, that is, I can totally see that. That's a very interesting reading. And I mean, I know they can't quite coexist with each other. Well, they can. I think they can coexist with each other.
Can you make that? I think they might be able to, too, but can you make that connection?
Well, I don't know if they quite connect, but I don't think they're in contradiction to each other.
Yeah.
You know, so on the one hand, he's saying what an act of faith, or how impressed Jesus might be with this woman's willingness to give the last of her money to her community. And on the other hand, can also be saying, you know, so praise on her. And and also, twice over now, you have brought this woman down. But I think you can both say this woman has shown tremendous faith.
Yeah.
And also, this institution is so corrupt.
Yeah.
And has abused this woman in ways that she doesn't even understand she's being abused, you know? And again, it sort of looks at, you know, earlier in this section, we were talking about the sort of dual commandment of loving God and loving neighbor.
Yeah.
Right? And so this is, again, sort of putting these things together. How does your religious tradition and your religious leaders, how does it actually treat this?
Yeah.
This person in their life.
Yeah. So we've started to make the transition a little bit already to our closing question that we always ask, but I'm so interested in, like, there's so much going on in these three texts that connect to life today. And so when you're looking at these texts, when you're thinking about like our current environment, our current world, but also like the very specific world that we are in right now, in which the coronavirus pandemic's kind of dominating the world, What kinds of connections are you drawing between the text and us?
I mean, I think at least on a broad level, the first text and the last text we read, not so much the text about the definition of the Messiah, unless you can help me tie that in, really have as a central component of them this idea that we talk about a lot. And one of them is our interconnectedness, you know, and our and the importance of our interconnectedness and the holiness of our interconnectedness, and that it is not accidental that we rely upon each other, and that we like that's what holy community is made from.
Yeah.
So I think these texts really highlight the realness of our interdependence and the holiness of our interdependence, and that is how we are built to be. We're in one of these moments as a Western American society of folks who surely like to be independent. It is very clear the ways in which we impact each other for better and for worse. You know, I mean, we could talk about things like people's decisions to isolate or not to isolate, or people's, you know, focus on their own health as opposed to the well-being of folks who might be in more vulnerable populations. Or things like, I mean, I stopped at the grocery store on the way home, and you really would think, like, I mean, the shelves are cleared out. Like, guys, if you buy all the soap, then no one else is washing their hands.
Right.
Like, that's bad for you. You want everyone to wash their hands. Yeah. And so I feel like that's not a very, I don't know that that's a particularly creative, like, it's not a particularly nuanced reading of these texts.
Yeah.
But I feel very aware of our dependence on each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
At this moment.
Yeah.
What do you see here, Bobby?
So the first place that my mind has gone is with this last story about the widow's contribution. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that it reminds me of is that we have created a world in which the hyper-rich are, like, so rich, and the poor are completely impoverished. Mm-hmm. And then hyper-rich people, like, do something like give, you know, a few million dollars to, like, I don't know, to fund a school in a poor neighborhood.
Whatever, a very good cause. It's a good cause. We're glad they gave the money.
They do good things.
Yes.
Yeah, some of them do some good things with the money that they have, but it's a very small amount of their money. Mm-hmm. And what one could do is structure society in such a way that there were just, like, good schools were available for people, rather than, you know, having it be tied to the richest rich people getting, like, a respect in the press, right, or whatever, because
and enabling those people to decide,
right? Yeah, yeah.
What merits funding?
Yeah. So this thing where, you know, the wealthy are devouring the homes of widows and then turning around and, like, being publicly showy about how much money they give, like, that's reminding me of this system that we have created in which the wealthy get wealthy on the backs of injustice, mm-hmm, toward the poor, and then are very showy about how they're going to help the poor.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just a bad system all the way around.
Right.
The other connection I was making at the beginning is this thing about loving God means loving one's neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that a lot of religious communities that I know, and I'm probably yours, definitely the ones to which I'm connected to, are worrying right now about whether or not to hold services, yeah, and things like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I said to one of my friends the other day, like, Mercy Church decided this week not to hold services. We fed a meal to go for people. We cooked, mm-hmm, dinner, and then we handed it to people and let them take it with them. But we didn't have our usual, like, dinner gathering and worship.
Mm-hmm.
And what I said was to one of my pastor friends, I said, well, I just feel like we're in a moment where we don't need to have unnecessary gatherings of people. To which his response was, fairly so, I think, is worship really an unnecessary gathering? Right? Like, which, yeah, I mean, was kind of convicting for me. Like, yeah, I mean, worship is the thing that we're supposed to do, right? But this text is this bit about, like, it's not, God is not looking for burnt offering and sacrifices, but loving God is in caring for the neighbor.
Yeah.
Has made me think that the way that we care for our neighbors right now is we do the best we can to keep vulnerable people from becoming infected with, mm-hmm, virus. Mm-hmm. And what that means is not gathering in mass gatherings where we're going to transmit the disease to each other. And so maybe in this moment, the best way of worshiping and honoring God is exactly not endangering our neighbor by having these big public gatherings. We find other ways of, you know, other ways of worshiping, other ways of engaging in acts of justice and mercy. And like, God can handle it. Like, God gets what's up. And like, we can all get back together in a few weeks or whatever it turns out to be. And it'll be fine.
Yeah, there's a Jewish value, I guess, pikuach nefesh, to save a life. And the teaching in the Talmud is that if you can save one life, it's as though you've saved the entire world. And our community has been looking to that teaching a lot in thinking about, like, if we think there's one person who might be impacted by the fact that we have this service, it doesn't have to be someone in the room. It just has to be someone in the room who then goes home to someone who is who has a compromised immune system. Or, you know, we have to think long and hard about what's the over and under of gathering, even though we really do want to gather. And then the question is how to facilitate a sense of connectedness between ourselves and for ourselves, between ourselves and God, in this time when we may not be able to be physically in a space altogether.
That's right. And to me, that was very obvious. Yeah. And last night at Mercy Church, like, one of the things was, so one good was, we want to try not to get our friends on the street sick, because that's going to be terrible.
Yes.
But our solution to that was, well, we're not going to gather. But the thing that my Mercy Church folks most feel is social isolation and a lack of community.
Yeah.
And so by way of trying to keep you healthy, I'm like depriving you of community. And that doesn't feel like right to me yet. So that last point you were making, and I honestly don't know yet how to do it in my own context.
Right. I mean, your context is tricky because a lot of people are going online, but like not everyone's got, you know, an internet connection and a laptop to just be able to live stream right in, you know?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. It's tough stuff.
It is tough. So, lots of good things to think about. And certainly we at the Bible Worm podcast are thinking about and struggling with
all of you
in
your communities.
For sure.
Y'all take good care of yourselves, especially community leaders who listen. It's a it is a stressful time, and your well-being is important to your community and to us.
Well said. All right, Amy. Hang in there. Stay healthy. See you next time.
See you next time.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. The theme song was sung by my 2-year-old daughter, because we could all use a little cuteness right about now. We'll be back next week to discuss Mark 13, 1-8 and 24-37, which deal with the end of the age. We'll try not to read too much into it. See you then.